Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. This is lecture 11, color. So just before we move on, I thought I'd just remind you of a few things. So final project proposals were due today at noon. If you haven't yet sent that in, be sure to get it in as soon as possible so that we can be sure to approve it or give you feedback on it as necessary. And of course, the final assignment number 4, is due 1 week from today. The submission instructions are largely the same, but you can find them online. There's an announcement on the course website, and so all the usual stuff there. But I did want to show one thing off really quick, and just more of a teaser than anything, really. I know that people have been asking for a while for some way of viewing all of the other images that have been submitted, and I am working on a way of doing that. And so there's this work in progress website where you visit it, and it basically will show you a slideshow of several hundred, not all 1,500 or so images that we have up until now, but it will show you a subset of them, but you will be able to view additional photos as well by going into each assignment, like albums of each assignment, and actually being able to preview each one. And it's still a work in progress, as you can see. There's some stuff that isn't exactly up to spec, like this is ugly, don't look at that yet. But hopefully that will be up soon, and we will be able to show that off, and you can show off your work to each other as appropriate. So last week we were talking about digital cameras, and we wrapped up our discussion talking about some of the low-level details about digital camera sensors and micro lenses and color filter arrays and all of this stuff. And I hope that you didn't leave wondering why on earth we were talking about this stuff, why it applies to digital photography, why it's important. Well, just to reiterate, this stuff is really important because it impacts the quality and of your photos and how you would be able to take them. So cameras that have color filter arrays, you now know will behave differently than cameras that work based on this fovean-like idea, where we'll review that in just a little bit. But also some of the behavior that we see through digital cameras occurs because of a lot of this technology as well. And when we talk about artifacts, we'll talk about some of the, in more detail, some of the bad things that can happen as a result of all of these low-level details that we've talked about. For example, these micro lenses, they're lenses, and because light travels at different speeds through this lens, it can actually mean that we get some strange color artifacts through them. And so sometimes you'll see purple fringing, for example. That can be a result of the lens or the micro lens, and we'll see examples of that stuff. But and even more generally now, when you are thinking about working with or modifying an image, knowing some of this stuff can help you make a determination about what sort of changes or modifications you can make to that image to really optimize it. So, for example, especially when we're talking about histograms and color, like we will be today, you will really be able to understand and hopefully realize what you can and have a better idea of what you can and can't do in order to make an image look its best. And so I want to do a quick review from some of the material that we went over last week, where we have this breakdown of an image sensor. And so remember that we have at the very top here, what's that element up there? Yep, so it's the micro lens, and there's one micro lens on top of pretty much every pixel, and its job is to do what? Yeah, focus the light that is coming in from the lenses, especially wide-angle light that comes at very oblique, very harsh angles. Focus it down into this very narrow channel called the well, and make sure that it hits the photosensor so that the photosensor itself can detect the light. But before it actually hits the photosensor, it has to pass through this block of color. And what we only see a red one here, but we oftentimes see other colors as well. What is this thing here? Yeah, a color filter array. So this is the thing that because we have photosites or photodiodes that can only detect intensities, so dark to bright and grayscale, you can think of it as, they can't actually quite see color as you and I can see color, as we would expect to see color, then we have to trick it so that we can only see, for example, all this photosite can only see all of the red color, and the one neighboring it can only see all of the green and all of the blue. Then the next layer below that, it's more abstract, but it's the actual electronics that's involved with the sensor itself. And remember that I showed a pretty complex diagram. You don't have to remember that or really know it very well, but just like a computer chip, it has a number of transistors on it in addition to the photosite itself. And so those transistors that surround that photosite take up space, which gives us the reason that we actually need this lens to begin with. Then we talked about the different type of color filter arrays, CFAs, that we had. Most common type being the Bayer filter, which has the color in this pattern. And remember that we had blue, green, green, blue. Blue, green, green, red. We had it in this array because green is the most prominent color. It's the one that we use to detect luminance the most. And so it's best to have that. It's best to have more information in the green channel than it is in other color channels, where for human vision just don't matter as much, so to speak. And so there are different ways that we could arrange these color filter arrays, and in fact some of them do. For example, Sony cameras will have something funky like emerald arrays and all sorts of weird stuff, but it really depends not so much on the Bayer filter itself, but on this algorithm called the demosaicing algorithm that is used to reconstruct the image that really defines the quality. So arguably, Bayer color filter arrays would be higher quality, not because the filters themselves are higher quality, but because they've had time to work out the kinks in their demosaicing algorithms to reproduce the colors that existed between among these four pixels here. So remember that because of this color filter array, that gives us, in addition, this notion of every pixel not actually being a pixel of all color information. It has to be reconstructed where previously there was none, and so we can get slightly blurry images when compared to pixels that perhaps could capture all three bits of color information at once. And so because of this reconstructing, or this demosaicing of this color, we can lose some of this fine detail. We can get some artifacts as a result. And some of the examples that I showed last week, if you remember that high-frequency stuff that we had where there was a texture, for example, in jeans, where it changed very quickly from a darker blue to a lighter blue, to a darker blue to a lighter blue, that detail is lost here because if that happens in a small enough space that, let's say, this dark blue falls in this row of pixels, light blue falls on this row of pixels, it's going to confuse this demosaicing algorithm, and it's not really going to know. It might show you some intermediate color when it tries to reconstruct what the color is. It might do something that we don't really expect, and we would see some of those artifacts that we saw. And we will see more of those artifacts at a later date when we talk about Moira and some of these other effects that can happen. Yes?
I'm curious, when we see the channels in Photoshop, for example, can we see the color from, let's say, the green cells and the blue ones, or is it just
Good. So when we view the color channels in Photoshop, can we actually see each pixel? So, for example, can we see this one in its blue component and this one in its green component? The answer is usually no. Usually when we view an image in Photoshop, it has already been processed in some way. And one of the first things that's done to process an image is to actually perform the demosaicing. So when you view the individual color channels on pretty much any JPEG, really, that hasn't been explicitly designed for such, then you will see the demosaicked color channels that exist there within it. And it is possible, I know it's possible, but I'm just not sure of the exact steps, at least not offhand, but you can open an image, a raw image, in Photoshop without processing it, and there is some way to actually view each of the individual or the mosaicked colors as they exist, and it looks pretty interesting. But that's not something that I could demonstrate right now. It's a bit too difficult. But yeah, it is possible. But usually, no, you will not see that. Okay, so because we have this demosaicing, there's this algorithm that has to occur where we have to use all of the neighboring pixels to determine what the color is for that individual pixel, and because of that, we run into this problem where we can't actually calculate the color information at the very edge of the sensors. And so we get this problem of a difference in the number of sensors, or the number of photosites that we have, the effective number or rather the total number of pixels that we have versus the effective number, or how much that we have after this demosaicing. And so if you remember, that's when we take a look at digital camera specifications, we will frequently see effective pixels that are slightly lower than the actual number of pixels on the sensor itself. And it is because of this demosaicing algorithm, we can't actually compute all of the original data that we had lost. Okay, and so there was this competing format for it, this Fovian X3, where we still have to have three unique color sensors, or three unique photodiodes, because we still can't detect color. But we use the absorption of light, the property of silicon that defines light absorption as it travels through it, to determine where to put those sensors. So red light, for example, can travel farther into silicon, can travel deeper into this particular layer of silicon than can blue or green light. And so what we do is we layer photosites at those particular depths, and we're able to detect the color at that one pixel for all three color channels. And so there's no demosaicing that has to occur, but the result of this is, because this is not, unfortunately, it's not as popular of a sensor type, we usually see slightly fewer megapixels. However, this doesn't actually mean that we have less detail, because a Fovian sensor that has fewer megapixels could actually have the same amount of information as a much larger megapixel Bayer-type sensor. Yes?
Is there an issue with depth of field, depth of focus of this, because you actually have multiple focal planes?
Oh, that's an interesting point. Is there a difference or a problem with depth of field or depth of focus because of these different depths? I haven't heard of any. Let's see. Conceptually, I would say offhand, making an educated assumption here, I would say probably not, because the light has... Once it hits the top of the silicon, it's going to travel down, and most likely they are accounting for, or they have already had to deal with, focus issues where the light travels at different speeds through the silicon. And so because it's already hitting some interface between air and silicon, I presume that the light will not split anymore, but it could very well cause a difference in focus. I'm not sure. I would say no, though, probably. Yes?
You mentioned that the CFAs, the Bayer CFAs, they have better quality. But everything you've said, so because they've been around longer, the algorithm is more sophisticated. But everything you've said so far would indicate Fovian's much better, and there are all these problems with Bayer.
Okay, so when before I mentioned that Bayer is better, I was referencing that it's most likely better than the other types of color filter arrays that exist, because it is the most popular, and it is more popular even than Fovian, but still we have these physical limitations where at every photo site we're throwing away two-thirds of our data. We're throwing away the blue data, the red data at all of the green sites, throwing away all of the green data and the red data at the blue sites, so on and so forth. So we have this physical advantage with Fovian, where we can, at every pixel, determine all three of these so-called primary colors, at least primary in the sense of how we would think of it on a computer. But Fovian is not without its disadvantages as well, because we have this notion of using silicon to allow light to travel through. We can have some light that is not, that is perhaps picked up by the wrong sensor. So maybe it's picked up by the green sensor, then it should have been red light, for example. So what we see typically with Fovian isn't demosaicing problems, but we usually see noise, what's called chroma noise, which means variations in the actual color itself. Especially as you start to increase the ISO, you'll see a lot more, let's say, blue noise, or you'll see a lot more red noise, whereas you typically don't see that same sort of noise in a Bayer filter camera, just because the Bayer one, they've had a long time to work on it. And in this case, Fovian, I think, will inherently, because of how it works, will inherently have greater chroma noise. But I would wager that if it was as thoroughly developed as Bayer sensors, then it would probably give them a lot more, a lot better run for the money in terms of the chroma-noise as well. But right now what we see is that the downfall of Fovea is that it's relatively low megapixels, though we can counter that this isn't that big of a deal, that it has relatively high chroma-noise, which is a pretty big deal, and that it's just not widely available. So it's expensive, and it's only found in specific sets of hardware that we may or may not want. Good questions. Was there another one? I thought I saw somebody else's hand. Okay. So then we have this idea of dynamic range, where we have that's the amount of light that can fill up our buckets. Remember, it's the amount of light that we can read divided by the minimum amount of light that it takes to get a reading. And so if we have dynamic range that's too small for the camera, then we can get an image that looks like this, which isn't very high contrast. And so this is the pinhole photo, but this is from last year. I just forgot to swap out the photo for this year. But the point remains the same. The dynamic range here, even though we have a little bit of a blip in the lower end here, the majority of this is somewhat low dynamic range. And so you can see that overall it just, I mean, there's some color, but overall it just looks sort of flat, not very contrasty, the photo. So we can increase the contrast and widen the histogram, but we also then will be decreasing the amount of dynamic range that we can actually view in a particular image because we're widening the histogram. Okay, any questions on that? Good. So then we talked about analog to digital converters. So analog or sensors are analog devices. As electrons or as photons hit them, they get a certain amount of charge in these transistors. And when we need to read this charge out of them, we have to convert this analog charge, which could be anywhere, as was the case in this example, from zero volts to 1 volt. We need to convert it over to a digital format. And that's what this analog to digital converter does for us. It converts the analog signal into an actual digital form. And so if we have a sensor that is capable of a very high dynamic range, remember this could be one that has a very large bucket, which means that it could withhold or it can hold a lot of photons in that bucket, and its read noise or its the minimum amounts is very low, which means that it has a very large dynamic range. If we increase the dynamic range for a particular sensor, we also will have to increase the analog to digital converter to make sure that we have enough values to represent all of those stops of dynamic range that it is capable from that sensor. But this brings up this idea that sensors are linear devices. So when we double the number of photons hitting a sensor, then we're doubling the voltage on that sensor as well. And so that means that as we get, so the very topmost section, for example, represents only one stop because we've doubled the number of electrons. That's only one stop of range here. And that carries over into this digital conversion. So when we have a very large space, so in this case we have a 12-bit sampling, which can go from 0 to 495, that means that the top half, so 2048, the value 2048 all the way to 4095, represents only one stop of information. And so this is good in that we then have a lot of information in that one stop, but it's bad because that's not how we perceive the outside world. That's not how we perceive light. It doesn't look strictly doubling and halving in light to us. And so we have this tone curve that is applied to that linear data to make it appear as though we would actually look at it. So for our eyes, we don't see a lot of the details in the very bright section. So in other words, we don't see a lot of whereas the camera sees a lot of details in the brightest sections of the image that don't overexpose the sensor, we see most of the details in the mid-range. And that's where this hump in this curve comes in. What we are doing here is we are exaggerating the values in the mid-range from the output of this sensor so that it looks, this image appears as though we are actually looking at the scene. So what we're doing here, you remember that the top half here represents only one stop of information in the camera. We are compressing that data down because it's not as important to us. You notice that we're only representing the tiniest bit. So you notice that it's relatively flat at that top half most, and that's because what we're doing is we're saying that only that all of these values are only represented within, let's say, the top 50 values rather than the top half of a JPEG's 8-bit format. So we are mapping all of these values here, we're squishing them down and fitting them into a much smaller portion at the top of this JPEG file. We're exaggerating the midtones and sort of squishing, we're compressing the highlights and the shadows, and we're extending the midtone regions to map how we would actually view this particular thing. And now, this tone curve seems like the craziest thing that we've talked about, but it's also arguably one of the most important. Modifying the tone curve changes in a great way how an image can look. And when you process an image, so whether you process the image in a camera by saving it as a JPEG file, or whether you process a raw file on your computer and save it as a JPEG file there, some tone curve has to be applied to it in order for you to actually see the information that's contained within that file. And many times, Nikon cameras in particular, especially the higher end ones, you can actually change the tone curve in the camera itself so that you can maybe make the shadows a little bit more prevalent. So in other words, you can compress the midtone regions a little bit and maybe get a little bit more shadow, which doesn't mean that you get more shadows in it. It doesn't mean that you get more data in the shadows. It just means that you're changing essentially the contrast at different portions of the image because you're compressing some parts and decompressing others. Any questions on this? Yes?
But the same output you can do from the RAW file, right? Do it on camera.
Oh, I'm sorry?
Can't you do the same thing when you process the RAW file? Why should you do it on camera?
So, yes, you can do the same thing. Well, you can adjust the contrast on a raw file while you're processing it on your machine, but the tone curve is not the same. It's slightly different than that. What you were saying is you are actually mapping the 12-bit linear data that we have into an 8-bit file. So it's doing more than just increasing the contrast or decreasing the contrast, but it's also telling what data to fit into this into an 8-bit file, which has many fewer values than this 12-bit file, and so it's possible to be to get different artifacts out of a file that you apply a tone curve to and then increase the contrast to, or one that you apply a tone curve to a different tone curve to and then apply some contrast too. So you can get, for example, if you change the tone curve slightly, here's an example sitting right here in front of us. So this image here, you see pretty much every week when I come and plug in my computer, this image had some tone curve applied to it. And this was just the default tone curve that came with aperture that is associated with my particular digital camera, the Canon EOS 20D. However, what happened was that I tried to, in order to get it to look a little bit more dramatic, I would increase the contrast a bit. I changed the black point to match, you know, these colors here. So even though in the original photo you can still see a little bit of detail here, it just seemed more dramatic if that was a silhouette, and exaggerating then the color found around the sun. But what happens by doing that, by increasing the black point to some level that this became black, and then increasing the saturation enough that I got a pleasant yellow and orange color out of this, what happened was I get this halo effect that's here, because there's already, it had already applied a tone curve, and it was trying to get more, let's see, how can I explain this without confusing? So it's trying to get more saturation out of something that is already completely saturated, is already completely white, so we get this weird halo effect out of it. But in the next version, which if you remember I showed earlier in the, let's see, I'm not sure I have that now, but I had a second version of this photo that when, you remember this one, this is the posterized version, that's not the one either. But in this one, no, not even in that one. There's another version where a different tone curve was applied to it, which, though I can't give you specifics at this point because it happened a while ago, it was adjusted such that after increasing the saturation, there was no halo around the sun. So by adjusting the tone curve, you can achieve a different end than you can simply by adjusting the saturation or the contrast. Yes.
Well, if you have a raw image file, so it has the full 12 bits, are you losing data if you then want to apply a curve, say in Photoshop or?
You only lose the data once you process the image. So after the tone curve and all of the modifications have been applied, then the resulting image is an 8-bit image, and you've lost the remaining data.
If you export it to JPEG, that's when you lose it. If you're playing with the raw file, that you still have all the data that you had.
Right, but it interprets that data differently with a different tone curve. So if we had one. So if we had a tone curve, for example, that rather than looking like this, it now would it would reach 255 a lot sooner. So let's say that we compressed it this way, and we still had this curve here, but all of a sudden we reach sort of the very top of 255, which means that right here at this point we have, you know, at about 2500. From the value, a value of 2500 from the sensor itself, we're saying that's a value of 255. So then after we process it, we're going to lose all of this data. And so applying a tone curve like that means that depending on how it's processed in the end, you really can't get the data back that may have been here, for example. And so it's how the software interprets the raw data that the tone curve is changing. So you can then affect the output from processed file by using the tone curve. Yes?
The big problem I see is you have a limited view area on your camera, so you cannot really evaluate very well your result by applying the effect only by experience you might get.
Right. So, yeah, when you're looking at a photo on the back of your camera, you definitely do lose a lot of the information, because when it shows that to you, it has to apply a tone curve in order to show it to you. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to see the image. And so it's just going to apply a default tone curve with default contrast, default saturation, and you see that there. And so the good thing about that is that because you really aren't seeing the upper stop, at least. I mean, you see it, but it's just not very well represented. You do have additional values and additional leeway when processing that photo, especially if you have slightly underexposed the file. But you really don't get the full picture by looking at the photo. But this is where the histogram can help you, by looking at a histogram. Even though it's most likely had a tone curve applied to it already, you would be able to see if, because of that tone curve, if you are overexposing some values. So you would still have an overabundance of values in this upper range, for example, and you would still be able to tell that it is overexposed. So this doesn't change all of the things that we've talked about up until now. Using the histogram is still an excellent way of being able to tell when you're underexposing or overexposing an image. The tone curve is just how the computer interprets the output from the sensor and shows it to you in the final image. Do you have one more for me?
Yeah, but I don't want to keep.
Okay.
It doesn't make sense to me that they would apply the tone curve to the histogram, because it's not telling you the real data that's available.
It's not applying the tone curve to the histogram. It's applying the tone curve to the linear sensor output. And unless they do this.
But in order to create the histogram, you're getting results of the tone curve.
Right, but the camera knows that you don't want all of your data up in this upper stop of range. So
but if it's under 4,000, it's still still able to be brought down and differentiated.
But it would, if I can bring up the slides from last week, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but this is a very good question. If you look at the histogram from a raw file, it looks largely underexposed. It has a very large bias towards the left side. And this would do more to confuse people than anything else, because most of the time you would see variations only on this left half. You wouldn't see much, if any, data here unless you're overexposing your image. And so by looking at this histogram from a raw file, we can see that, sure, we have a lot of the data in these in the mid-tone regions, which is represented by this left third or so, but we also have just a little bit overexposed here. But after applying the tone curve, these values would still be represented by the highest values allowed by 8-bit, by 255, and so you would still see a little bit of a blip. But what that does is that the tone curve compresses all of this stuff down, and it makes this become a lot more legible in a histogram. And so we then can understand much more intuitively, because we don't look at light in a halving or a doubling, we would understand much more intuitively that it's a more even distribution of tones. That is a good question, though. Thank you. Okay, moving on. So I just want to quickly then go even further back and talk about the eye, because this is really important. This is how we define color. Is it all happens in the eye. Remember that we have the macula, which contains the fovea, which contains most of the cones that are responsible for our detailed vision. So we only have a very small percentage of the eye that can view much of the detail that we see. And so remember that we have rods and cones. And who can remember what the difference is? What are rods and what are cones? Right, very good. So I guess you guys also have the thing, so that doesn't help very much. But okay, so the rods are the night vision and the cones are day vision. And so what this means is that rods are then more sensitive to light, whereas cones are less sensitive to light. So rods we don't have in the fovea, so they're primarily found surrounding it. And this is why this brings up this idea that I mentioned before. If you are outside, if you are adapted to dark light, try not to look at something directly, and you will be able to see it much better in dark light. There are many more rods than cones in the retina. However, in the fovea, we have the majority of the cones, and so we have the majority of our eye itself taken as a whole. We have a lot of rods, an overabundance of rods, but right in the center, right where we're actually looking at stuff that provides us detail, we have all of these cones, and rods can't really give us color vision, whereas the cones can. And whereas rods can give us motion, so that we have very good perception of motion, particularly in our outside of our direct field of view, then the cones will give us very good detail. And so we had this graph here that shows us that we had three different types of cones: the small wavelength, the medium, and the long, and they detect different. They respond to different color light in a different way. And so we have the majority in an average person, and I guarantee none of us are average, they're all going to vary quite a bit between all of us. You just take the average human person, 98% of the cones will be these M and the L types. So that's why, remember, that we have this prevalence for green when detecting luminance, is because it's from this M-type cone. We have then a color spectrum that we can view, which varies based on the wavelength of the light as it travels and it hits our eyes. It stimulates particular cones, and we can then recombine in our brain, the visual cortex can recombine, and we can detect the color that we see. But color perception is actually surprisingly difficult, and I don't mean that in terms of us perceiving the color. I mean, how we perceive color is very strange, and our brains react in very strange ways because of these differences that we have. Because we have this, because we do have different types of cones in our eyes, and so our brain has to recombine some of this data. We, just like digital cameras, can have artifacts that can happen as a result as well. And so I want to show you a couple of optical illusions to try to convince you of this, and also to try to make you realize that something that you are absolutely convinced is being true that looks, you know, by appearance on your computer screen may not necessarily be true. And this will bring up the importance of color, of dealing with color profiles and making sure that colors are absolutely correct just because of this very thing. So we have here an optical illusion where we have a tiled floor and you can see that we have a cylinder that's blocking some of the light. The optical illusion is that the color of the tile, of the tiles A and B, are exactly the same. B appears to be lighter, but it is not. And so to prove this to you, I'm ready for you guys. I'm going to prove this to you here. So we have here the slide that I was just showing. And remember that I have this digital color meter that shows us the red, green, and blue values of all of this. And to show you that it's working, I move over something white. It shows 255 for red, green, and for blue. So then we can just figure out what the color should be for everything under my mouse. And so if I'll move over here to A, you see I'm right near the A, and now we see that we have color value of 120, 120, 120, which defines a gray color. Okay, and so now I'm going to move the mouse over B, and numerically, it's exactly the same. There's no difference in the numerical value. And this is because of how we perceive this scene, whether it be through just clues that we've had through experience, where everything that we see under a shadow should be darker, therefore these things are being made lighter. So one way that we can describe it is that you notice that right at the edge of the shadow here, we are darkening everything. But if you notice, particularly in this light tile that's here, we are making it darker as we get closer to the shadow. But what our eyes, what might make physical sense, but what our eyes don't perceive is that as this gets darker, this color actually matches this A, the color of the tile of A here. And so just because we have this context of the darker tile right next to it, our eyes are saying, okay, well, that it must be lighter than this color that we had previously. And so this is one of the wackiest ones that we can have, I think, because most optical illusions, you can sort of shake your head and look at it a different way, and it looks right. But no matter how many times I look at this, it gets me every time. This one is really wacky. It's a really crazy optical illusion. Yes, the color of the tile of B is exactly the same as the color of the tile of A. Okay, moving on. I've got a couple more good ones to show you. Okay, this is a photo that I took modified in some way, and I want you to do me a favor. I want you to stare at the black dot in the center for about 30 seconds, and I'll try to keep you entertained by blabbing about stuff. I'll talk about this picture. How about that? So just keep your eyes centered very well right there on the black dot. Okay, so this photo was taken of a building in New York City. I just happened to be there one year, and I thought I liked the difference in the color. And you can't really see it right now, but trust me, you'll see the difference in the color in just a second. But what I thought was really striking was this just the texture of the building. The color of the building contrasted against the sky. Are you ready? I changed the slide. Okay, so you see it now. Blink your eyes, look around for a little bit, and then look back at it. Did you see the illusion? What had happened was that this photo here was an inverse of the colors from that photo. So this was a red building. When you invert it in Photoshop, it becomes blue. The blue sky becomes this sort of muddy orange, this sort of muddy red. And as you look at the center of the dot, your eyes become used to the colors. They adjust so that the colors do not impact the signals as much. And so whereas previously, in the previous example, you could see that our perception of color is impacted by context or by experience or how we actually view a particular scene. This is a physiological reaction. Our eyes are actually adjusting. The cones are adapting in such a way that they literally try to block out the color that you're looking at. And so when I change to this black and white, it retains all of the texture. But because your eyes have now inverted, so now they're used to seeing the opposite color, because we are seeing this black and white in texture, when you keep looking at it, even for a brief second, you can see the original color that this image had, which was that bright red and that bright blue. What's that?
It takes a long time.
It does. It helps if you kind of close your eyes, you look around at other stuff. But if you keep staring at the other one for a while, you will really see that blue and red for a while. And it's really cool, I think. This is very fun. You can actually make this pretty easily. Just in Photoshop, you can impress all your friends with this in Photoshop. Just put a black dot right in the center and invert the colors. Well, invert the colors first and then put the black dot. Save that as one file. And then just convert it to just a standard grayscale. There's just a way you can desaturate the image. Just desaturate it completely, save that as another file, and you're done. And you can have this really cool optical illusion. Okay. Now, you can see that the way that we perceive color then is somewhat fragile. We're impacted by whatever it is we are looking at. And so what we perceive as being a particular color may not actually be the true color in terms of the raw value, in terms of how physically that value actually is. Our eyes are playing tricks on us, and our brains are playing tricks on us, both. We have two things working against us. And so we then have these very literal machines, digital cameras that are supremely literal. They take everything and they don't muck with it. They don't mess it up at all. And so we then have to try to make our perception of color match what these machines, or rather, we should make what these machines perceive as color try to match how we perceive it. And so we have this idea of color spaces, where we can represent the entire spectrum of colors that we can see, everything from a deep violet all the way to the brightest of red, right before ultraviolet and right before infrared sides of the electromagnetic spectrum. We can represent all of this color, not just in this 1D format, but also in a different way, in a more two-dimensional format. And so what does this mean? This is sort of a typical graph that you would see when people are talking about color spaces. And what this means is that we have along the x-axis, it approximates the chromaticity. So how much, you can think of it loosely based on like how much color it is, just how much chroma that particular color has. Then along the y-axis, we can approximate luminance, which makes sense, right? Because you can see that at the very top, we have very bright green. At the very bottom, we have this sort of a deep blue. And then at the, you know, sort of a third of the way, we have this red, which matches what we were talking about with luminance earlier. So as you start going up higher, you start getting more, it looks brighter, even though that color may be completely present. So a very bright blue, for example, just won't look as bright as a very bright green. And that's what this y-axis is showing us. So this graph is used to represent the entirety of what our eyes can perceive. All of the colors that our eyes can perceive, it's inaccurate to say that it's represented here, but this graph is meant to represent all of the different colors that we can see. And so by mixing these colors, we can get very different or very unique things. So for example, if we mix a blue and a red, for example, we would expect to get purple, yeah, which if you do, you can just kind of find it in the middle. It's this purple color. So along this graph, you can find any two colors, you can average them and find what mixing those two colors would be. Okay, so let's say we just had, just for the sake of argument, we had a blue light that was giving off light at 380 nanometers, and then we had a very red light at 700 nanometers, and we were sufficiently far away that the two lights were sort of merging in terms of, you know, and we were mixing the color, we would then see this sort of purple that exists there. So then we can do the same thing with a blue and a green, and we can get sort of a teal, sort of a turquoise-ish color that exists here. But there's something important that can happen as a result of this. Remember that I said that when you take two points on here and you average them, you get this sort of what's the one that's right in the middle is the mix of those two colors. But what that means is that we cannot then mix every color and get every other color. What I mean by that is, let's say that we take this deepest blue that exists here, and then we take the very brightest green that we have there, and we average the two. It's going to be somewhere around here, right? The resulted mixed color. But that's not as colorful as the actual teal that can exist in the real world. And remember that this is important, because every time we look at a computer screen or a projector, they can't put out monochromatic colors. They can't put out exactly this color right here. They have to mix together variations on red, green, and blue in order to mix the colors together and to show us, or what we would perceive as being, this color spectrum. So if we only have those three colors to work with, you can imagine that there's some colors that we simply cannot represent, that exist in the real world, that we simply cannot represent using a monitor, a projector, a computer screen, what have you. Especially this side right here, this big curvy side, we're going to lose out on a lot of data there. And also in sort of this green area right here, or different areas within this green region, we just simply cannot represent those green colors that exist in the real world. So what I'm trying to say is that even though mixtures of light can appear to be a monochromatic light, so we can mix a red and a blue to make it look like it's only purple, it doesn't necessarily mean that that is the most intense, or that that is the most saturated version of that color you will ever see. And that is especially evident, again, with the blue and the green. You will get this sort of mid-range teal that isn't as saturated as the one that you would see at the edge. And that is, of course, happening here. This teal, turquoise that you see here isn't as turquoise as anything can ever be. But this is just meant as a representation of the colors that we can perceive. So then we have to have this idea of actual color spaces. Color spaces can have some particular green value that is that 255, if you remember. So when we are saying that green is 255, there is some literal physical version of that green that is represented by a value 255. Similarly, for red and for blue, there is some actual light, there's some actual monochromatic light, when shown, will represent that color. And so we typically see color spaces in this triangular form, where there is some dot that represents blue, there's some dot that represents red, there's some dot that represents green, and then everything inside of that triangle we can create by mixing those colors together in some form or another, but we lose all of the rest of the colors that exist in the world. And this color space that you see right here is the most popular color space. It's called sRGB. When you're using a JPEG file, something that you find on the internet, the most common, the most casual, color space that exists is sRGB. You typically really can't go wrong with it, because most devices understand the sRGB color profile. They know what it means. They know what each of these colors should mean. And so remember that for an sRGB photo, so one that we have applied what's called a color profile of sRGB to it, we are saying that when we have some pixel who, let's say, has a red value of 0, has a green value of 0, has a blue value of 255, that means that in the physical world, it should be this blue right here. It should be shining out this blue that exists right there at the corner of this color space. Similarly, for all red and nothing else, it's only this here. So obviously the sRGB is nice because we can capture a subset of the colors, but it's not nice because we're lobbing off grand amounts of data of color that we can actually perceive. Yes?
So this limited color space, it exists for cameras, it exists for monitors. Does it exist for prints, which use
yes.
magenta, cyan?
Oh, yes, definitely. Printers Printers definitely have this same idea as well. So the cyan, magenta, the CMYK color space, for example, would have 4 points instead of 3, presumably. Is that true? No, one might be intensity. So no, that's probably not true. But it is true that printers do have color spaces as well that are subsets and can be defined based on their inks. So the very bluest of their inks can only be here, for example, or maybe it's over here. And this idea that all of these devices can have different color spaces, are capable of producing different colors, is what brings color to be so difficult to us as digital photographers. So just as a quick teaser before a break, this is a different color space altogether. And you'll notice that the red and the blue are largely the same, but now we have a much greater capability of displaying green. So back to sRGB, we can only display so much green. But back to this Adobe RGB, we can display more green than that. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break, let that sink in a little bit, and when we come back, we'll talk more about color profiles. Okay, welcome back, everyone. So continuing with color spaces. So just to put this in other words, and just to make sure that this really, that this idea really hammers home, I just want to explain that what we perceive as being colors is represented by this graph as a whole, by this funny-looking shape. You'll notice that along the edges of it, we actually have these numerical values, 380, 460, 470. These are the actual wavelengths of light, of the actual light itself. As we move from, let's see, I have to go back a few slides, but as we move across this color As we move across this color spectrum, going from one side, completely deep violet, all the way through the green and through the yellow, all the way to the red, all of this data, this is basically just one dimension worth of data. So we have, you know, all the way at about 430 nanometers, that's the smallest wavelength that we can perceive, all the way up to about 680 or so. That is represented along the edge of this graph here. And so these are monochromatic colors. Remember what I mentioned before, where monochromatic colors, if you have an actual light that is somehow able to produce exactly this value, then you will perceive that color to be not necessarily very bright, but you just perceive it as having a certain saturation, very colorful in that particular color. And what happens when we are talking about color spaces is that computers can only represent a small subset of the colors that we can actually perceive. And that is because of limitations of the hardware that exists today. It's just not possible because we're mixing colors to be able to receive these super super deep blues, the super bright greens, and everywhere in between. Yes?
Might see the difference in the colors if we put that prism on top of a picture.
Right, so if you were... Right, well, putting that same idea in another way, when we take a photo with a digital camera, the camera, even though it records some object as being very, very deep blue, it can only tell us that. So even though the object may have been giving off some light that was, you know, this blue, for example, so we had some actual, some actual element that we were stimulating in some way that it was actually giving off this 380 nanometers wavelength. As soon as we take a picture with the digital camera, if it's able to represent that, it would only represent it as being this blue, for example, which is not as blue as the actual thing. And so I know that this, because what we're using a projector to display this, or you're sitting at home and you're looking at the slides on your computer screen, what you see as being the deepest blue and the deepest red fit within here. So even though we have this graph to represent that there's additional blues and reds, just realize that even though this is probably the bluest blue that this projector can represent, in the grand scheme, in the reality, it's only really this blue, and we can actually perceive things that are much bluer, so to speak, than this. And so we have, yes?
I would like to conceptualize this. If you took the curved edge of the outer Lawson shape thing, mm-hmm. straightened it out, would that essentially be the spectrum?
That's exactly what I was trying to say. If you take this curved edge and straighten it out, that's exactly the spectrum that what we were seeing before. This is the blue. It goes up through the green, the yellow, the orange, and then all the way to the red. And that's what these numbers represent, is that along the outside edge, these are the monochromatic light, the monochromatic wavelengths of that light. And every time we mix light together, we can mix, you know, one or more colors together to get the perception of some other color. So we can, for example, mix red, green, and blue together and get the perception of white. It's just those are multichromatic. Those colors have multiple monochromatic components to them, and they're just not as saturated. They just don't have the same impact as the monochromatic light would. And that's what I was mentioning before. Combining or taking a deeply blue light and a deeply green light and mixing them together so we perceive some sort of a turquoise, some sort of a cyan in the middle, is not as bright as if we actually just had a real cyan light. And I don't necessarily even mean like an incandescent light that's painted cyan, because even that is a mixture of colors and may not be truly cyan. I mean some way that we can actually truly get this exact wavelength from some object. Okay, yes?
Would a film camera be able to record the exact?
So cameras should be able to actually perceive all of these colors as well. But even film cameras cannot, I mean, because they're limited to the inks that are used to print them, there is still some gamut that must be defined within this space that tells us how much color we can actually perceive. Even though all of this color may be represented in the data somehow, it's just a physical limitation. We just cannot show that data back. Yes? Yes.
Is that reflective of the fact that you're sensitive to the green, so not as much space needs to be devoted to green?
Yeah, well, there's multiple things going on here for why the green is underrepresented. One, like we've talked about many times, green is extremely important to our vision in terms of luminance perception especially. And so that's why we have this sort of strange shape where the majority of this is green and all of these values within it, because it signifies some importance for that color or that spectrum or that side of the spectrum of color for us. But we are also limited in a physical sense by the actual greens that can be reproduced by these objects, whether it be printer inks or monitors or projectors. They can only display, for example, maybe not this exact green, but you know, somewhere around here, some green that's not as green, not as saturated green as we are able to perceive. So it's sort of a multifaceted problem. It's our ability to perceive it in a great way and our inability to reproduce it in a proper way. Okay, so this is sRGB. Consumer cameras, every time, even your prosumer digital cameras, if you take a photo and save it as a JPEG, 9 times out of 10, unless you specifically tell it otherwise, it is going to take the photo and represent the colors in that photo in sRGB. And what I mean by that is that, remember that all of these values, for the red values, the green values, and the blue values, they have a value from 0 to 255. And when that value is displayed back via the back of your camera or on the computer, the target, what the computer is trying to do is trying to say, okay, the value 255 for the blue channel is this blue right here. And so this is the color blue that your monitor is trying to show you. Whether or not it's doing that, it depends on a lot of factors, and we'll get to that in a minute. And the same thing with this red over here, if it's a completely red pixel or a completely green up here. This is the value that 255 means, is this green right here. Okay. Now, we have this idea that there are other color spaces that exist. We have color spaces that can take up a bit more of this green portion. So, for example, Adobe RGB, you'll notice, has a larger area triangle. It extends a little bit into the blue, but it also, more importantly, extends up higher into this green region. So I'll just go back and forth a couple times just so that you can see. So sort of ignore the color differences in the actual in this actual spectrum itself, but just look at the difference in the triangles. What this means is that Adobe RGB would be useful for scenes that have a lot of green colors in them, because then you could represent a green color that is much brighter, or much more saturated, not brighter necessarily, but much more saturated. You would then be able to view that color back. That color would then be shown back to you by the display. Okay, but there's a couple of things that I need to mention. So remember that when we're talking about color spaces, we're not changing the amount of values that we have to work with. So for we can have the JPEG that has an 8-bit, a JPEG is 8-bit, but we can have an 8-bit JPEG that has an Adobe RGB color space. But all that means is that the value 255 for green just means a more saturated green. Doesn't mean that we have fewer values in either sRGB or Adobe RGB. It just means that that value, that 255 value, means a different green in that JPEG than in the sRGB JPEG. Okay, so we're not mucking with any of the data. We're not losing data necessarily. We're just saying that the colors mean something different. The values mean something different in terms of the colors. Okay, so... And that brings up an important point, where we have all of these devices. They're all capable of showing us different color spectrums, but we have these sort of standard color spaces that these photographs come in, and that we need to make sure that among all of our devices, when we say a value of 255 in the blue, and it's this blue right here, we need to make sure that we really mean this blue, that we're actually viewing this blue on our monitor. They're actually viewing that blue on our printer. And so we have to modify based on profiles. We have to profile a lot of our devices so that we know, so that the computer can figure out what it has to do in order to make sure that the color remains the same between all of these devices. And so you've probably heard, especially if you've looked around in Photoshop a lot, of color profiling. And do you want to work in this color space? Do you want to work in that color space? And it's confusing at first. You have no idea what's going on. But this is what it's talking about, is that if your monitor is correctly profiled and you are working in a specific color space, when you then print that photograph, for example, that printer presumably is profiled so that we know what colors that printer is capable of producing, then we can map those values from the color space into whatever it will be that will cause that printer to actually make sure we get the blue that we want, to make sure that we actually get the green that we want. And so this is the importance of working with color. It's to make sure that when you're looking at something and perceiving it on your monitor, even though it's some subset, we have to live with that, with the idea that we can only view so many colors on our computer screen. That's not much can be done about that for right now. But what we want to do is to make sure that how we view something on a computer screen will translate to these other mediums as well. Not only from my computer to a printout, but from my computer to your computer. I want to make sure that when I look at something, that I'm sure that it looks the same on your color monitor. And this is where the importance, where the idea of this color management comes into play. So we have then these color spaces where we are working with the photo in a particular color space, which means that all it means is that some value maps to some literal physical color. And different color spaces can mean that different values can map to different colors. And so even though, I mean, it's not a lot of difference, you may not actually be able to perceive a change when you do a conversion. It's important that you work in a color managed space so that you know that the colors remain the same from one computer to the next. So when we profile something, what we are doing is we are finding out what colors that device is able to produce. So we might have a monitor, for example. So let's just go back here. So we might have a monitor, for example, that has very somewhat large triangles. So it can actually produce colors like this. And so it can display then all of the colors of the sRGB. It's actually some subset of what this monitor is capable of, for example. And so we could actually view more colors on that monitor than what the sRGB space would show us. But that is important to make sure that you don't distort it, so that you don't make sure that you don't stretch this sRGB out, because then how you view that photo on your computer with your awesome monitor is going to look different than how somebody else views it, maybe with their crappy monitor that can only perceive the sRGB color space. So you'll say, oh, this photo looks great on my computer. I don't know why it looks crappy on yours. The difference is probably is that your monitor's not profiled very well, and that how you are perceiving the color space is different than what their computer monitor is actually able to reproduce. So if all you wanted to do was just make your monitor look stunning with your photos, then maybe you don't really care about this. But I bet that you are trying to share your photos with other people, and people outside of this room, you have to assume, are not going to understand this stuff, so you need to make the color work for them. You need to make sure that your color, the color for your photos, looks right on their monitor, so that when they see it, they are impressed on their computer, not impressed on your computer, because nobody cares, frankly, about how your photo looks on your computer screen. They care about how your photo looks on their screen. That is where this importance comes from. Was there a question? I'm getting a little worked up about this stuff, so stop me if you have a question. Okay, so you can see that we have different types of color spaces, like I said. Most of the time, you're going to work in sRGB, and it has this really funky name because they've had different versions of it. It's like sRGB, IEC, 2.... It basically just means the same thing. I'm abbreviating it to sRGB in this case. But we have this idea of different color profiles. And so when we do a conversion from one color profile to the next, we have to decide what to do when we are performing this conversion. Remember that Adobe RGB can represent a green that is far more saturated than our basic sRGB. And so if you are working with a file in Adobe RGB and you want to put it on the internet, you want to make sure that it is then converted to sRGB so that you know that it's not going to look very different on a different computer screen. And so you have two major ways of adjusting how it can look. You can change it perceptually, or you can change it like literally. We have two different ways of doing it. Perceptual, where you try to fit that wider gamut of colors. So maybe you have a lot of that really bright green, and you try to fit it just by squishing those colors into the smaller color space. Now remember, I'm not changing values here. These 8 bits, this value that was still 255 over here, still 255 over here, we're just saying that in this color space, the value of 255 doesn't mean as much, right? So what we're saying is that we're just going to fit all of these colors that were in this larger gamut into this smaller one. And this makes the most sense for photographs, because then you don't get any sort of weird artifacts as a result. It might look slightly less saturated, but we have sort of gotten used to that when looking at photographs on computers. So for example, I'd be surprised if, especially for those of us that have slightly older cameras, I'd be surprised if the monitor, the LCD screen on the back of that camera is capable of producing the same gamut of colors that your computer screen is. And so when you look at a photo on the back of your camera, it's squishing, you know, these values that your screen could potentially produce into the gamut that is possible by that display. And so, but you still see, you know, the entire range of colors being able to produce that are able to be produced by that particular device. And so perceptual is generally the way to go when we are talking about gamut mapping or changing color spaces from one to the next. So given the choice, use perceptual, where colorimetric is used to take a literal translation of those colors. So for example, here we realize that this deep blue in this wider gamut color space cannot be produced by this smaller gamut space, and so we're just going to cut it off. We're going to ignore it and say that, okay, we're only going to take the colors that we can truly be produced by this color metric into this smaller gamut space here, which is good if you absolutely must keep the colors the absolute same, rather than have the scene as a whole look the same. Does that make sense? Like having the actual change in gradations appear to be the same by using this perceptual versus actually lobbing off some of the most saturated colors in this color metric change. Yeah, generally scientific. For the general case, I'm just showing it here to show you what it means. In the general case, you want to use perceptual. We as photographers want to use perceptual color metric or gamut mapping changes. If you happen to be using or doing any sort of astrophotography, maybe then you want to start to consider color metric. But even then, only if you are doing something scientifically rigorous, I would argue. So I think this seems like a good time to show you the color space or to show you the color settings that I use in Photoshop on my computer, just because then we can go over some of this stuff and you might get a better idea of what some of this stuff means. Well, except when you get a could not show color settings because of a program error, then, all right, so here we go. This is on my computer at home, and so we might get some weirdness, but basically this is color settings on Photoshop, just an earlier version of CS1, but it applies pretty well. They haven't changed this too much over the years. And so you'll notice a couple of things. In the working spaces, almost all of the time, my pictures are destined for the internet, for the general case. I'm sending it to other people on the internet via email, over the web. So I'm going to use the more popular one, the sRGB. Even though it is not the highest gamut, I'm not creating these images just to view on my computer. They're destined for elsewhere. So I want to make sure that sRGB is the way to go. Now, I don't do a lot of printing. So I have pretty much just left the CMYK, the gray, and these bottom three the same, just because I don't think I've ever worked in any of these color spaces unless I'm just trying some trick or something like that. So sRGB is where I spend the most of my time. So now we have color management policies, and what does this mean? Well, this means that when I open an image, and it has some particular color space associated with that image, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with that color space in this image? And so if I open an RGB image and it has, let's say, not sRGB like my working space, but instead has maybe Adobe RGB, for example. So someone is, maybe one of my photographer friends is working on a photo that's destined for print, for example. He decided to work in Adobe RGB. He sends the photo over to me for whatever reason. I open it, and RGB, and since that color profile doesn't match my working space, which is sRGB, then it's going to ask me what to do. And so the default, I just want to preserve the embedded profiles. I want to make sure that I keep that Adobe RGB versus doing something stupid, which could change my perception of that color, like convert to working RGB, for example. If he's showing me something and deliberately kept it in one color space, I don't want to change that color profile. The time that this gets annoying is that sometimes if you take a lot of screenshots, for example, where sometimes your computer won't apply color profiles to just a screenshot, then you will get this sort of thing a lot. But that's only if you are a true geek and like to take screenshots, I guess. So again, I don't work a lot in CMYK or gray, so I left those at the default. For profile mismatches, I ask I have it ask me what I want to do when it opens it. This is related to the above setting, but this is useful when that Adobe RGB photo is opened up and I realized, oh, it's this photo for some reason is not actually supposed to be in Adobe RGB. I can either replace the color profile or I can do some sort of a conversion to the proper color profile. So then it says, okay, let's assume that we're actually going to make some color profile change. That's what where this conversion option comes in handy. So the engine is basically just what is going to do the gamut mapping, what software is actually going to perform the change. I think the default is Adobe's, and I leave it to Adobe's. I think there's some other options as well. But the intent, and you should recognize this, is perceptual. I want to keep this at a perceptual change because I don't want to just lob off color that I may have had before. So I want to make sure I gamut map as appropriate for my digital photos. I use black point compensation. Remember, black point deals with levels. It's what value represents black. Seems like a good idea to compensate for the black point. And also, dithering is where, let's see. Dithering is sort of the opposite of, well, that's a bad way to explain it. So if for some reason I am unable to reproduce some color in a gamut that my previous color space could produce, then dithering will try to mix some colors from nearby pixels so that it appears when viewing at it at a distance that the color will be as original as possible to the original color space. And so we could then try to trick ourselves into getting additional colors from a narrower color space by using dithering. However, you are then altering some of the actual color information. You're actually altering some of the pixels. So that's perhaps a controversial setting, but I honestly have never had any problems with any of these options. Advanced controls, where we would desaturate monitor colors or any of that, I don't typically use those. Yes?
If you don't preserve an embedded profile, let's say you change Adobe to RGB, sRGB, Adobe RGB to sRGB, and you lose some of the color that you had, and then you need to use dithering, would you then, even if you were using perceptual intent, would you then lose some color data?
Can you say that one more time? I want to make sure that I understand the steps. So,
you have an Adobe RGB photo.
Okay, an Adobe RGB photo, huh?
And you want to convert it to sRGB for the web.
Yes.
And you get some dithering.
So most likely, well, let me just preface this by saying that most likely you will not get dithering in that scenario because the Adobe RGB color space pretty much completely encompasses, so this is Adobe RGB, it pretty much completely encompasses the sRGB. So there's no colors in sRGB where when we mix them together could give us the perception of having some of these other colors. So
you'll just get a less saturated.
Right, you just get a less saturated image. So when you move from a higher color space to a lower one, assuming that your monitor is actually capable of showing you the colors of the higher color space, and that your monitor is also properly profiled to show you those values properly, then you would, when you do a perceptual intent modification, a perceptual gamut map from Adobe RGB to sRGB, it'll just look slightly less saturated, especially in the green region.
And what about the reverse?
The reverse, that depends, I guess, on the type of conversion that you use. I guess if you use perceptual, it would probably look more saturated, just because those same values then, so that green that used to be down here is now slightly higher in
so
green.
So I guess the question is, if you get dithering for some reason,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure now why you would ever get it, but if you did get it, that color space is affecting the information in the file, right?
Well, dithering, yes. So changing color spaces does not change the values in the file. But when you perform dithering, then you probably are going to actually be modifying values within the file.
It's kind of like inducing artifacts to get an effect.
Yes, you could argue that you are inducing artifacts to get an effect, yeah. But I would say that...
So it's irreversible.
Assuming you save the changes, it would be irreversible, yeah. But you all are working in raw, right? So none of this really... That conversion doesn't really matter because you can go back to the raw file and get as much data as possible from the original raw file and fit it into the proper color space that you want to work in. Okay, so then this idea of color calibration is very important. And in fact, I have this. So this is just a typical color chart. And let's see. So it's not very noticeable here, but on some monitors, what you can see, especially when looking at a color chart like this, is that if you take a look at this grayscale version, you will notice a difference. So some grays might actually have a different hue than others. So this might look completely white. This might look completely black. This would look slightly brighter gray, slightly brighter. But then this one might look slightly more red or slightly more green, somehow different and somehow not perfectly gray than the rest of these gray slots. And so profiling your monitor is important not just for making sure that you get the color space absolutely right, but also that you don't get these strange artifacts that are produced by it, because your computer is sending the monitor a signal saying, I want a gray at this value. And your monitor thinks that it knows what gray value that is. And so it's going to actually show that gray, which may not be the intent. Your computer might want some color, but your monitor may actually display another, if that makes sense, just because of differences in manufacturing, because your monitor sucks, because your monitor is great. I don't really know. It could be any one of these or all of the above. And so by profiling your monitor, and you can do this by eye. There's usually some software that will help you do it by eye, but frankly, it's not the best way. You really need to do it by hardware. It's like a little puck. They call it a variety of things. It's just some little device that sticks onto your monitor either by suction cups or just hangs off the edge like this. And there's some software that displays colors. And the software then reads what color the monitor is actually displaying, and then it can map. It can actually profile the monitor and say, okay, when I say this value, the monitor shows this value. So then it can correct and adjust and actually show you the proper values that you expect from your image. And so it really depends. Laptop monitors in particular are very bad about this. It'd be difficult to show you, but on this laptop, for example, I haven't profiled it, but this gray right here looks surprisingly brown rather than being a true gray. And so I can tell then that my monitor needs profiling in order to properly show it. In fact, it looks really bad. These two are kind of greenish, and this one's kind of brown. This is a little bit more gray, and then this is also a bit brown. And so if you should try to take a look at this on your computer and see if you can detect that difference. And once you do detect it, it's going to drive you nuts until you profile your monitor. So I certainly recommend it. There are different monitor types. So not all LCDs are created equally. There are some LCDs that are better than others, and there's a variety of terms and names for them. If you really are serious and if you really are interested, I believe the best one is SIPS. That's the best sort of, I haven't checked in a while now, but I believe that's the best one in terms of color reproduction. And typically you'll see this on more expensive models. And so if you see a somewhat expensive LCD and wonder why on earth is it so expensive, it most likely has a better panel, a better monitor panel within it. Apple monitors in particular, their laptop ones used to be very good. Now they seem to be going downhill. But their monitors in particular receive a lot of flack for being so expensive. However, they are the better, the more expensive panels. And so there is something to the saying that these Apple monitors are better for creative professionals, for photographers, for anybody that works in this space, because their panels can actually produce additional colors that other ones cannot. And in fact, laptop panels are especially notorious because not all of them actually are 8-bit devices. So some laptops we would expect to be able to at least show all of the colors produced by a JPEG, some of them actually are only 6-bit devices, which means that in hardware, it actually performs some dithering on colors to try to make you perceive this additional detail that you're losing. And so laptops are not really recommended for modifying or working with photos, especially if you're serious enough to start talking about color profiling. You would want to try to avoid those in general. Even I must say, Apple laptops, they seem to be, digital photographers have started to notice. And it's sad when they can notice an actual difference in the quality from colors from the older PowerBooks to the newer MacBook Pros. Okay. Yes. That's a very good point. Yes. So monitors do degrade over time. It doesn't matter what type they are. They just will not be able to show as bright colors as they were before. So it's important once you profile your monitor to continue doing it, not just once, but maybe another month or so from now, maybe another few weeks or so from now, just to make sure that you are absolutely sure that as your monitor ages, that it is still able to reproduce the color that it can. And there's a lot of talk out there about high gamut monitors, about these monitors that are capable of showing really wide gamuts or a really high amount of colors. And those are only useful if you're not going to, or if you're going to print out some of these photos or put these photos on a medium where you are going to be able to reproduce that entire gamut. If you're just destining your photos for the web, then maybe you don't need such a high gamut monitor. You can spend a little bit less and get one that you're absolutely sure covers sRGB and maybe Adobe RGB as well. Okay. Gamma. So gamma is related to all of this because in order for the monitors to display this data to us properly, it has to apply, you can think of it sort of as a tone curve here as well. So there's a curve that's applied from the monitor, from the signal given by your computer to actually produce what we see on the screen. And so gamma, you can really quite literally think of it as being contrast, the contrast of your monitor. And gamma is actually varies between computer to computer. Macs, for example, by default, will come with a gamma value of 1.8, which is not very contrasty. It's not as contrasty as Windows PCs, which they say is about 2.2, but most Windows machines, when you unbox them, they like to try to increase the contrast a little bit so that, you know, things, you know, you sort of get wowed by the contrast that comes out of it. So many Windows computers by default will come to about 2.5 or 2.6. So what this means for us is that we have to adjust our gamma on our computer to make sure that we reach the widest target audience. And so if you are going to produce your images for web, or for the general use, then if you are a Mac, unfortunately, you'll have to change your gamma to 2.2 because this is sort of the industry-wide standard. What the internet as a whole in general is set to is this idea of 2.2. And that's also useful for Adobe RGB. So if you're using, whether you're using sRGB or Adobe RGB, you want to change your gamma to 2.2. And you may ask how to do this. But when you profile your monitor, you're almost always given a gamma that you want to set the monitor to, and you can set a target gamma, and then you will be running at that gamma. And you can create different profiles. So you can create a profile for your monitor at 1.8. You can create a profile for your monitor at 2.2, and then you can more quickly change between them. And Mac OS, in particular, I guess I can show you. I only have a Mac computer with me now, but it's pretty easy, especially on Mac OS. You can just go to the displays, and they will show you a specific color section. And there's actually a very fancy thing here called Calibrate, which allows me to calibrate my monitor. It will create a profile for my monitor. And this is software only. It's not using any of the pucks or any of that fancy hardware technology that I mentioned before. But if I turn on expert mode, then it does some tricks basically of the eye to try to figure out what the gamma or what all of this stuff should be. And so as you keep going through it, eventually you get to pick a gamma. And so just watch as I, let's see, is it going to, oh no, it changes it on the, oh man. Let me try it on the other, let's see if I can, I was calibrating my computer's screen, not the actual projector. All right, so now you can see that it's slightly different when it detects that it's a projector. So now if I increase the gamma, do you notice a difference in the contrast? Right now it's much less contrasty. As I increase the gamma, it's more contrasty. So before, I believe it was at the max standard, I think, when I first started this. But if we were actually going to be working with this and working with photos in a realistic way for the web, then we need to adjust it to 2.2. Yes.
Is that why pictures that histogram indicate the properly exposed seem a bit overexposed to me?
A bit overexposed. Oh, so why? Oh, okay. So if your histogram looks properly exposed, but your screen looks slightly overexposed, mm-hmm. Are you on a Mac?
No, PC.
So it most likely has something to do with profile, with the color, with the profile on your monitor, or what's even more likely is that the monitor is simply too bright. Mm-hmm. There's actually very stringent, well, not rules, regulations, but what people consider to be sort of de facto standards on how bright your monitor should be given the amount of ambient light in a room. So when you're working with photos, if you're really serious about this, you have to get a room that it's essentially a dark room, but you have a couple of lights in there. There's no outside light. The sun will greatly affect how you perceive the colors on your computer, especially if you have a very sunny room. It will change how you view the colors on your monitor. And so you'd have to have different profiles based on different times of the day. And in fact, on my computer at home, so this is my computer at home, and let's see if I can do this without wasting too much time. So I can go to the system preferences here and view the display. And you'll notice that I had actually profiled the monitor different amounts for different levels of brightness, because I noticed that during the day I needed the monitor to be a certain brightness. So you see here these three, 2407, that's the model of my monitor. And then I have different brightness and contrast levels on the monitor itself. So for example, during the day, the brightness level of 25 is not bright enough for me to see the monitor. But a brightness level of 50 works. But then during the night, that blinds me. It's just far, far too much. So I have to decrease the brightness a little bit if I want to actually perceive the colors as being proper. And so I profiled the monitor at each of these brightness levels to make sure that I'm getting the proper color at each level. And so honestly, though, I've noticed it's been a while since I've calibrated, and my monitor at home is now much worse than even this laptop, where it's very obvious, even in grayscale images, they have this certain hue to them. It's just this very, or it's just sort of a red hue at some levels and green hue at others, and it's disgusting. I really gotta fix it. But anyway, this stuff then will allow you, if you have your monitor properly profiled, you have your gamma properly set, this will help you adjust your photos so that they look good, so that they look proper on as many computers as you want. If you're on a Mac and you are modifying a photo at gamma 1.8, when you move that photo to a gamma 2.2 machine, it's going to look a lot contrastier, and if you've already increased the contrast, it may be too much. It may look wrong in some way. And so you want to be sure, especially if you're on a Mac, that you get this stuff right, that you get the gamma right, because then you will be sure to get all of this, to perceive the colors properly from one computer to the next. Okay, so white balance. So white balance is certainly related to all of this color. And this is slightly different. We have to change gears a little bit, where before we were talking about color profiles and how a value for some color is shown by a computer or printed on a paper to make sure that we get the color right. White balance is comes into play because of how we perceive the color white in different scenarios. So right now we are under fluorescent lighting, which typically gives off a very green light. And if you've played around with white balance at all, you've probably noticed this, that your photos, especially if you have a film camera, for example, and you're using outdoor film in incandescent lighting, it looks pretty green. And that's because the light that's given off has a different bias of colors than other lights. But our eyes adjust. Our eyes and our brains adjust for this. This goes back to this all of these differences that we were noticing because of the optical illusions. So, for example, light that we see in the midday is different color-wise than the light that we have near the dusk or the dawn. And so we have this idea of color temperatures. And so you know this idea of something is red hot, or there's a blue flame, for example. That's where this color temperature comes from. There's something called black body radiation, where an object that has a specific temperature gives off radiation, and that the majority of that radiation has this sort of color bias to it because it's given off in this color, and so. Our sun, I mentioned this early on, our sun has a certain black body radiation, and it actually works out to be right smack dab in the middle. The majority of the radiation given off by our sun is right smack dab in the middle of our color perception. So what we perceive as being color is also happens to be the most amount of radiation emitted by the sun. Whether or not that's coincidence remains to be seen. I mean, we could be confusing correlation with causation, but it's pretty strong circumstantial evidence. But as the sun goes down in the day, because of as it moves to sunset, then the light given to us from the sun, not because there's a physical change in the sun, but because of the way that the light is coming through the atmosphere, it becomes warmer. And so, well, what we consider warm is sort of more orange and more red, but in terms of black body radiation, it's actually cooler bodies that give off warmer things. So remember that the best way to remember this is that a blue flame is hotter than a red flame, right? And so the reason that it's blue is because it has a higher temperature, and it actually gives off a smaller wavelength because it's higher energy. But anyway. Just think of it as being the opposite of what you expect. As you increase this number, kelvins, this number in kelvins, you're actually making the light cooler. So as you go up from 3,000 Kelvin all the way up to 9,000 Kelvin, you have changed what we call a warm light into a cool light. Even though the reason that we have these degrees in Kelvin is because literal cooler objects actually give off what we perceive as being warmer tones. I hope that makes sense. It's sort of the opposite of what we expect. What we call warmer tones actually is not warmer at all. It's just a difference in perception. So we have variation in these lights, and our cameras have to adjust for it. So we can have anywhere, especially from candlelight, which can be very deeply red, all the way up through this sort of typical midday sun, which is over here at about 5,000 to more sunset type light, which is more 3,000, the camera will try to automatically pick a white balance for you. But I'm a big fan of taking a photo at auto white balance, letting your camera pick whatever it wants because it's usually wrong, and then going back and in with the raw file, processing it later and determining what the actual color should be. If you've profiled your monitor correctly, you can do this just by sight and say, okay, now it looks perfect. Now I've adjusted the white balance, so it's a little bit cooler than normal and it looks great. So now that's it. I can leave it there. But another way that you can do it is you can have a white card. And so there are usually some pretty expensive things that will let you do this, but I find even just a sheet of paper, just something white that you can shine in front of, just hold in front of the camera and use that to set a custom white balance, really helps a lot with the camera's ability to pick a white balance. And so you can really get some much better photos by adjusting the white balance. But still, I recommend doing it after the fact. Okay. So now we've seen this chart before, the difference between RAW and JPEG. But hopefully now it makes a lot more sense. Whereas in JPEG color, we've set these values at, for all of these colors to be at a specific thing. In a RAW file, we can go back and later adjust the white balance. And so even though we can apply a different color profile to a JPEG, that's not the same thing as adjusting the white balance. Realize that among most of these color spaces, what is perceived as white might only change very slightly, but it's generally considered to be, you know, something like this point that's called D65. And so if you change the color profile, you're not going to do anything but just do yourself a disservice, because it's not going to look right on other people's computers. It's still going to be improperly colored, and it's just going to look really crazy. So after all of this, RAW file, the conclusion is still the way to go. But hopefully after all of this, all this color management stuff, this color profiling makes a lot more sense. I really recommend profiling your monitors, because you will notice a difference in how you perceive colors. And I recommend, if you're using web browsers, to start using Safari or Firefox version 3, because those two are the only two web browsers that I know of that can properly manage color space information in a photo. Every other web browser, Internet Explorer, older versions of Firefox, throw out the color information and just assume that it's sRGB or something like that. So if you're ever looking at a JPEG file that had a color space of Adobe RGB in an old version of Firefox or an Internet Explorer, it's not going to look right. It's not going to look the same, even if you have a properly profiled monitor. So I certainly recommend making sure you use one of those if you are serious about this, because you may even notice that that colors or that photos with proper color spaces pop a bit more, that they look better just even perusing around digital photography websites or Flickr or a variety of other places where they preserve the color space information in there. Okay, well, thank you all for coming, and we will talk more next week.